Hello and welcome to the first episode of season two. Thank you so much for joining us for our next season. We have some very exciting things to cover. This episode, we are going to be talking about the election, reflecting on the results, the timing of the results, what demographics went which way, polling, along with a lot of other topics. So it's going to be an exciting episode. Now, without further ado, let's dive right in.
Okay, so at 5:30 on Wednesday, the 6th of November, the election was officially called. Trump had won. However, you could pretty much make your guess. People were calling it after he got 11 electoral votes. People said it at 8:30. People said it at 10:30. People said it at 12 midnight. You could really tell that he was pulling ahead from the very beginning. And especially when you, like, took a closer look at specific states like Virginia, where Kamala was supposed to win by margins and it was closer than she would have hoped, you could kind of tell that the energy in the country and the voters that voted Republican were really strong this election year. So, Latrana, what did you kind of feel when, not when you saw the results, but when you were watching as the states came out?
So, everyone who's listened to our other episodes or checked our Instagram posts knows that I thought it would be a close race, but I had Kamala winning. I was actually, like, very sure on this. Like, I was so convinced. And then it started, I kind of got a bad feeling as soon as it started when she had, like, zero votes and he had, like, 20. And logically, I know that that's because, like, that's because of what states just get counted first. Her big states, like Illinois and California and New York, their votes hadn't come in yet. But I still just got a bad feeling. And then I think around 8, I was like, oh, okay, he won. So that's kind of when I really realized. And then in the morning, obviously, we had the results. So I think it was just not as close as I thought it would be. And now kind of reading more after the election, that makes sense, but I was still shocked. I thought it went very differently from how I thought it would go.
Yeah, I agree completely. I thought that he was gonna win solely based off of past elections we've seen. I don't want to say fan base, but his voter base, I guess.
Yeah.
Tends to be really vocal and really passionate about him when he has run in the past. And I just thought there was kind of a very low chance that someone, not newer into the political space, mm-hmm. but someone who was thrown with 7 months into this election after it had been, 8 years, basically, for former President Trump, soon-to-be president, to kind of rally up his voters. And I felt as though she definitely did worse in the election than I thought she would. I actually think if she had a little more time, she could have stated some more policies, really mm-hmm. given a strong, clear plan on things. Not that she didn't, but, you know, more like the big winner for Trump was the economy and also the immigration situation we have at the border. And I think that if she really put her foot down and made her opinion very clear, made her stance very clear, what she was going to do very clear, and said it in a way that obviously differed from current President Biden, because he's one of our most unfavored president we've had in a very, very long time. People do not like him. And I don't think she strayed far enough away from him. I think people were worried that it was kind of going to be another repeat and they were ready to mix it up. And I think those three things were kind of the biggest giveaways of her election. It was her race to lose, as Ryan loves to say, and she did lose it.
Yeah, and I do believe it was her race to lose. I mean, if she came public opinion when she first came into the race was extremely malleable. Very. She was negative 18 percentage points favorability-wise, which is two times worse than Trump was before she was nominated. And it flipped to almost a plus one or two as it stands on a few of the averages right now. That just signals the incredible like form that she could take on. She could go in a lot of different ways because American people weren't as informed on her as they were on Trump. Trump, for all intents and purposes, information-wise, is an incumbent. Everybody knows who he is. Everybody knows his policies. And his name recognition is even better than some candidates who are in office right now. And that's just a product of, you know, the world that Trump has kind of made and inherited. And that, you know, it certainly contributes to the fact of the narrative being that Harris lost the race. I mean, if you look at the polling averages, she had a 65% chance to win this race for a pretty good time, a few weeks, and she's always been favored up until the last week. And Trump, he manages to pull off some pretty interesting stuff in the last week of every campaign that he's participated in, and we'll talk about some systemic stuff later. But it was just quite an incredible race because I think if she had, I mean, obviously they've looked at it and they've seen that generic Democratic candidates pull much further ahead in electoral college scenarios and popular vote scenarios than Donald Trump does. And I think her being able to shape her reputation, if she could have got that generic Democrat, and Trump really tried to paint her as the liberal extremist, which I think he did a bit of a good job at, I think she could have won the race. And I think that's kind of what it comes down to.
Okay, so now we're going to move into the Senate and House elections. So I think Luciana can talk about the Senate.
Okay, so the Republicans won the Senate 52-46. Most of the predicted states went blue, such as Washington, California, Michigan, Wisconsin. Well, I guess Michigan and Wisconsin obviously weren't as guaranteed because they went red in the election, but before they've kind of been considered the blue wall, so people were sort of expecting them to win. Then obviously, like, New York, and the expected ones also went red, like Texas, Florida, Mississippi. And then the big flip states were West Virginia, Ohio, and Montana. So that was kind of what changed things. The Republicans flipped three seats, which is kind of what helped them to win. Also, the Democrats had 28 seats that were not up for election, and the Republicans had 38, just to give some context to that. The most competitive states were Michigan, Nevada, Wisconsin for the Democrats, and then for the Republicans, Ohio, Texas, Nebraska, Montana, and Florida. So the Democrats did not get all of the seats that they needed to flip it, but the Republicans got more than they needed.
And then if we look over at the House election, that's actually still going on. It's going to take quite some time for certain states. Currently, the Democrats have lost two seats. They have 200, and the Republican Party has gained the two seats and have 212. You need 218 for majority, so it is looking as though it will go to the Republicans. Obviously, California is still going, Washington, Oregon, Maine, Arizona, Alaska, and Iowa. So, oh, and Louisiana, and a couple other states. But the main ones here, we see Arizona going to more towards the Republican Party, same with Alaska, same with two, it looks like, districts or, like, representative sections in Washington, and Iowa is
just waiting to finish counting theirs, but that is also going to go to the Republican Party. So it looks as though we will have both parts of Congress being controlled by the Republicans. So what does this kind of mean? So basically, we've talked about this before, but I'm going to mention it again because I think it's really important. Our government runs on a system of checks and balances. Each branch has things that they are allowed to do and things that they aren't allowed to do. So the legislative branch is allowed to make the laws, the executive branch is allowed to enforce the laws, and the judicial branch is allowed to deem those laws unconstitutional. That's how it works. The judicial branch can't make laws. They can only deem them unconstitutional. The legislative branch can only make laws. They can't deem the laws unconstitutional. They have a power that the judicial branch doesn't have. The judicial branch has a power they don't have. So, since we are going to have a Republican president, our Congress is going to be Republican, and obviously our Supreme Court is supposed to be unbiased when it comes to picking a political side. However, there is a majority that have been appointed by Republican presidents. So we also see the two oldest justices, the Chief Justice Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito. So these are the two oldest members, and they will retire under Trump so that they can ensure that their spot will be taken up, or they should, I guess. We don't know what they will do, but they should retire under Trump if they want to keep that 6-3 split that we see in the House. The way to continue that is if when they retire or leave the court, they then get replaced by someone appointed by a Republican president, keeping the 6-3 split, like I said twice now, sorry. But why this is so important is the argument that any legislation could, in theory, be passed and deemed constitutional. So without a system of checks and balances, this idea that you could basically just become a dictator is very present. Holy cannoli. I cannot speak right now. It's very present. However, there are a lot of people in the that identify as Republican that don't identify with Trump's MAGA beliefs. So we will obviously see pushback. Things that he has said he wants to do, like get rid of the Board of Education, won't happen. There are not enough people who agree with that stance. Now, there is obviously some smaller pieces of legislation that will have an easier time getting through I guess the two branches of government, and then if it gets challenged, it would have an easier time being deemed constitutional. This would be legislation such as Trump's plan to enforce tariffs on goods coming into the U.S., and minor legislation like that. Legislation that won't really change the way that our government is working. It'll just change certain things that all presidents are changing. So he will just have an easier time and less pushback on, or less revisions on those laws.
So another thing this brings up is Project 2025. So we did a episode on this a while back, but it's basically a kind of plan written by very conservative people for what the next Republican presidency should look like. So it includes things like not teaching critical race theory. It teaches things like...
The whole thing is to bring back traditional, and I say that in quotations here.
Family values?
Yes. The man, woman, two kids, goes to church every Sunday type of...
White picket fence.
Yes. Very white. Yes. Very white picket fence family. Their whole thing is to bring that back. This was written by people that are very prevalent in the Republican Party. It's written by people who used to be on his staff. They're written by people that are currently on his staff. So back to what Luciana was saying.
So I think before people were saying, like, I don't know if that could really happen because surely there would be some group that contests it. Surely it would be the Supreme Court that says, no, we can't do that, or the House or the Senate that says, no, we can't do that. But now that, all of these places are controlled by Republican groups, theoretically, it could happen. And I'm obviously not saying that every Republican likes this idea. Of course that not every Republican does. Even soon-to-be President Trump said himself, like, I don't agree with this. But it's just the idea that it could happen now because the all three branches are controlled by the conservatives.
Yeah, and obviously this argument can be made with, I mean, Obama had the same thing in, I don't remember which of his terms, but in one of them where he controlled all three branches, or the Democratic Party controlled all three branches, and he didn't actually get to pass everything he wanted to because of pushback. So we will see pushback, obviously, and we're not saying we won't. We are mainly just pointing out the fact that there will be less amounts of checks and balances, and also kind of restating something that we brought up a couple episodes ago on why it is super important to understand exactly the effects of your vote. Mm-hmm. Not only what the person you're voting in, the president or the representative that you're voting in, what they want to do, but also how that will affect the overall government system that we have in place.
All right, so some of the roundtable stuff that we're going to talk about, especially post-election, is going to be coming from exit polls. A quick little thing is that the exit polls you see online, there's two different types of them. There's exit polls that came out right after the election. I prefer if you don't look at those. There's weighted exit polls. They factor in demographic stuff. It's much more reliable and interesting.
Link the ones that we're using into the
show. Yeah, we will obviously. We'll link the Washington Post one. We might use some New York Times ones later, but most likely we're going to use the Washington Post one because it was the most recent, and they have some pretty good crosstabs and stuff. And the first thing I want to talk about was Trump's overperforming with Hispanic and Latino voters. He received 46% of the vote share to Harris's 52%. These don't necessarily add to 100 because there's third party and they do rounding and it's kind of very complicated. But he really overperformed with Latinos. Elle, why do you think Trump overperformed with the Latino population, especially in more southern Sunbelt states?
Yeah, honestly, I'm not 100% sure. I personally, like, from what I've heard him and his party say recently, obviously not in the past and not how it's gone recently about that specific group of people. If I was a part of that group, I don't think I would necessarily want to vote for that person. But I think a big part that plays into it is things like trying to bring American labor back into the U.S. I think with the tariffs, obviously, we're seeing Trump enforce these tariffs, or says he wants to enforce them, so that we can bring manufacturing back into the U.S. And this will open up a bunch of manufacturing jobs, which is really great for people who are doing other types of jobs that may be less...
More menial.
Yeah, more menial. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a big reason why he overperformed in that group. How about you?
Wait, Luciano, you want to go, or no? Do you want me to talk about
it? I agree with what Elle said. I honestly don't know. I honestly, like, can't understand why people would do that if their group is being criticized, but I think Elle's points do make sense.
Yeah, and we see it all the time. Like, it's less... I think people are caring less more about what the person is saying and more what the person's going to be doing, and I think... especially when their things are not being said about you as three privileged people that are white in America, we don't really have things that are harming us in words. So I think it's kind of hard to know how these people would be reacting when you have nothing to go off.
I totally agree with that. And I think there's two other things, they kind of both hit on them, that contributed to, you know, the Latino turnout that was quite good for Trump, as I said, especially in Sunbelt states, Texas, Georgia, places like that. And that's, you know, a lot of people thought that Trump's anti-immigrant, you know, sort of rhetoric, you know, cost him a lot of the Latino vote. But a lot, and from what I've been seeing in a few interviews, actually, is that there's a mentality, especially among the people who are voting, the legal immigrants, especially coming from, you know, more southern countries, is there's an us versus them. They think that because they immigrated legally, they don't necessarily believe that you should be able to cross a border illegally and then immediately get citizenship because they worked for it. And that's kind of what I've been seeing in a few interviews. But there's a general thing that we're going to kind of be referencing a lot in this little portion, and that's inflation and prices and cost of living, and that determined it for almost every group. If you look at the crosstabs and you look at who the people who are concerned about certain stuff, the economy rocked the charts. Democracy came in, I think, a close second in a lot of them. Immigration came in third or fourth in most of them. But the economy trumps everything, and Trump trumps Kamala on the economy in most polls. So that's going to kind of bring us, do you guys have any like interesting demographics you want to talk about particularly?
Yeah, so I want to talk about gender. So we saw Trump do better with male voters. He got 55% of the male vote, and Harris got 42%, but she did about the flip with women. So she got 53% of the female vote and he got 45%. Obviously, when you like break it down into ethnic groups, she did significantly better with people identifying as Black females. He did better with people identifying as white males. It kind of goes down to obviously how they care about the policy, but also people vote for the person that they kind of relate to more, how they can kind of see themselves relating to more. So a white male is more likely to vote for a white male president solely because they see themselves within that group, versus a Black woman is more likely to vote for another Black woman. It's just how things like that work in society.
Yeah, totally agree with that. And I think, especially with the woman vote, I think the Democrats, their fatal error was thinking too much. They dreamt too much about the 2022 midterms, where abortion ruled the ballot and women turned out, because women are typically more civilly engaged. But in this election, the women versus men turnout wasn't as egregious as it was in 2022. And women really didn't. They voted a split ticket on some issues in some states for referendums. But if you look at, say, a place in Arizona that's really been a contentious spot for abortion, Trump got 50% of the women vote compared to Harris's 49%. So you're looking at a place in which more women voted for Trump than Harris. That's rare to ever be seen in any state, let alone a swing state. So that's just, I think, a product of the fact that Democrats bank too much on abortion. I think there are a lot of women who sympathize with the abortion message. But I think when it comes down to prices and inflation and other stuff and security, I think sometimes that shows precedence over the abortion issue. And I think Democrats, this is their little awakening to that reality for them. And I think in upcoming elections, you know, the 2026 midterms, there's going to be much, maybe less of a full campaign made on abortion rights. So Luciana, I think she has a topic that she really wants to talk about.
Sorry, just to kind of chime in before she gets that, because it ties in. We were looking at the religions of past presidents, and they've already updated the Wikipedia page with Trump being the 45th and 47th president in both of his new terms. That's very interesting. They work fast over at Wikipedia. Go donate if you haven't yet.
Do you donate to Wikipedia, L? Okay, so our topic now is religion. So starting off with Catholic voters, they voted 40% for Kamala and around 60% for Trump. They make up 22% of voters, so quite a nice big chunk there. People tend to vote for a candidate that shares values of their religion. So soon-to-be President Trump is a Protestant Christian, so I think the Catholics could definitely relate to him sharing their values of Christianity. And then the Protestants voted 36% for Kamala and 63% for Trump. So again, I think they could really see themselves sharing those values. And for a lot of people for whom religion is a big part of their life, they think that it's like a good quality for a person to have. So I think that might have been an important factor for some people. And sorry.
And yeah, they made up 42% of the vote. Mm-hmm. So that was a super big chunk and a super, probably a really important group to kind of do good in when it comes to the religious breakdown. Mm-hmm.
I will also say that the black Protestants or evangelicals tended to vote very heavily towards Kamala, which I think is something she kind of leaned into talking about, like, her faith a bit during this election, but it was not enough.
Yeah, and also in the exit polls that we're looking at, none is an option. So this is not people who, this is like all voters, because none is an option. So if they believe in a higher power, or they're a part of a faith, or they don't, that's an option too.
And then next we have people who are Jewish. So they only make up 2% of the vote, but they voted overwhelmingly for Kamala, with 78% voting for her and 22% voting for Trump. Now, they are the only group that we have on here that just doesn't have any margin for other. The war we see in Gaza right now definitely played a part in affecting how this group voted. So I think a lot of people liked the idea of someone who would be giving aid to people. And then people who identify as other religions, so Muslim, Hindu, whatever they identify as, voted 60% for Kamala, 7% for an other, which is the largest group that we have, voting for a third party. Yes, thank you, Ryan. And 34% for Trump. I think this could also have something to do with the war in Gaza. A lot of people that identify as other, I think, could definitely identify as Islam or Muslim, as people could identify as Muslim, a part of the Islam faith, which is very prevalent religion, and they could want a candidate that is willing to support Palestine more. And then people who don't identify as a religion make up 25%, and they voted 70% for Kamala and 26% for Trump.
All right, like usual, there's some polling stuff. Mainly, we're going to look at it in retrospect, look at what the models said, look at what the polls said, and see how accurate they were, because a lot of this podcast up until this point had been us reporting and analyzing and looking at the polls, and we just want to tell you guys kind of what we see from the polls now after the election, and just kind of stuff surrounding that, and a few other things that I'll get to at the end. First of all, a little quick fun fact, the 538 model, which I used personally a lot, and they used most of the time, the most likely outcome of their few thousand outcomes they ran was the outcome that happened with Harris at 226. This was just a bit more likely than a Harris full sweep, which would end Trump at 226. Obviously, I'm talking about electoral votes. But I just thought this was a fun fact because it shows how accurate these models are at predicting elections. However, like usual, I'm not sure how it happens every year or every election cycle, but Trump managed to get some systemic polling error. This year it was around 4 points, a nationally popular vote. It's been like that for Trump all three presidential election years that he's had been on the ballot. The polls significantly underestimated him in 2016. The polls pretty good underestimated him in 2020. And they significantly underestimated him this year again, nationally and in state and municipality level. He looks like he's exceeding the projected by around 4.5 points, which is around what the polling error is. And that kind of... the reason those the 538 model was so hell-bent on those two outcomes being very likely was actually because of the fact, and this is what a lot of reporting actually said before the election, that it was very likely to be a sweep by either one candidate. Because if there was just a bit of systemic polling error, because the states were so close, it could have tipped the election, the scale of the election, so heavily one candidate that it could have been a full sweep. Obviously, there were tons of scenarios in which that would have never happened, but they were considering it. Secondly, quick victory lap. No, I'm just kidding. But I was right. Ann Seltzer's poll leading up to the election, usually she has some outlier polls coming up before the election, but not to be. Trump won Iowa handedly. I thought there were demographic errors, as I just compared cross tabs and the Ann Seltzer poll. didn't line up perfectly, like I thought. But, you know, you can't rely on one poll. You can't rely on that. It won't, remember, one poll, unless it's a very high-quality pollster, like CNN, New York Times, stuff like that, I wouldn't put much weight on them right now, future elections, midterms, whatever it is, just because of the fact that just a bit of sampling error could mean a few points in either direction, which is what happened in the Ann Seltzer poll. Obviously, this happens in a lot of polls. Hers are just more notable. And that's kind of going to wrap up just a quick overview on what happened to the polling. There was a bit of systemic polling error, undersampling of Trump voters. Maybe some people saying that they were going to vote for Harris, they voted for Trump, maybe because somebody was in vicinity. Obviously, there's a multitude of reasons why you can attribute it. And the last thing I do want to talk about was about the markets. There's been some funny reactions. Soybean markets have gone significantly down. I'll explain that in just a second. Stock market is reaching record highs. Bitcoin reaching record highs, and I'll talk about that in just a second. But quite a volatility in the market this week. And just to kind of start with Bitcoin, Trump has said he's going to be the most crypto president ever. You know, take that for what you will. But the Bitcoin people really love it, and it has exceeded its all-time high this week, I'm pretty sure. Stock market has hit all-time highs in a lot of segments, and well, I'll talk about soybean futures later. I can't wait to get to those, but first, got to talk about the Bitcoin. Trump has promised, and I'm quoting, he'll be the most crypto-friendly president on Earth, and that he will bring crypto back to the United States. Bitcoin people apparently love this. The stock has gone, you should have seen it on election night. It was just going higher and higher as the chance of Trump's win went higher and higher. As you see that, you're also looking at the stock market in correlation to Trump's win probability. Obviously, Trump and the conservative and Republican agenda in the United States favors deregulation. This is not new to the United States. This has been like it for a while. Obviously, the banks jumped quite a bit because of deregulation, especially from stuff from the 2008 financial crisis, was one of the key things that he, you know, he started deregulating in his first term, and most likely will continue to in a second. But to hit on what I think is one of the most fun things, soybean futures have dropped through the floor. Not fully, but they have certainly lost a lot of their value. This is mainly due towards, you know, Trump. He's saying 10-20% tariffs on all goods coming into the United States. Obviously, soybeans are a big, big export in the United States. If you've ever gone on a road trip, you see cornfields and soybean fields. And that's pretty much it. Pretty boring. But it is a lot of money you are seeing in front of your eyes. And a lot of that goes to China eventually. And if we put 10-20% tariffs on China, along with additional stuff because of the, you know, anti-Chinese or anti-CCP sentiment about regarding trading in the Trump administration, you could easily see a trade war, and the soybeans would become part of that. It's just kind of a cool thing. The futures dropped a lot, and it just shows kind of how much the presidency can affect the different parts of markets, even as far as soybeans and other crops in the United States. That's going to end off this episode. We got the outro, stuff like that. Thanks for tuning in. We hope you have a great day.
Thank you guys so much for listening to this first episode of the second season of Project 2028. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. And if you liked our new intro music, we will also have new outro music. We're going to change it for every season. I'm now going to shoot you back to Luciana, who is going to talk about our socials and where to reach us.
Okay, everyone, if you liked this episode, you can follow us on Instagram at project2028.podcast. We also have Threads and Twitter accounts that are linked on there where you can get updates about what we're posting and when, along with important political news. We have also started doing, we did our first live stream, so let us know if you'd like more of those. It was really fun to do it on election night, get to answer some questions,
So that was really great. And if you have questions, comments, concerns, or any topics you'd like to see in an upcoming episode, please.
Especially in debate episodes.
Yes, we need topics for debate episodes. We'll send out a poll for those soon. But you can email us at project2028.pod@gmail.com. We would love to hear what you have to say. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.